Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. I'm glad you're with us again today. Our goal in Central Coast Voices is to bring you credible, valid information and insights from diverse members of our community. It's interesting, the diversity in the room today are two gentlemen that I've actually known for quite some time, and we'll get into that in a little bit. So it's fun to have guests that I've both had on the show before and also guests that I've worked with in other capacities. Central Coast Voices wants to address how today's choices affect tomorrow's community, and oftentimes how things going on in our community have instantaneous ramifications or long-term ramifications. Central Coast Voices is a project of Action for Healthy Communities, an arm of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. Today we are going to talk about disaster preparedness and be Red Cross ready. And yeah, I guess the Red Cross is probably something that you're familiar with. So we're going to talk a lot about Red Cross issues, but we're really going to talk beyond that in a lot of ways. Hurricane Harvey, as you know, if you've been paying attention at all, which means if you haven't been Rip Van Winkle, you realize that we have an incredible, we have an incredible disaster going on right now and not going away shortly. It's been downgraded to a tropical depression, but there is still plenty of rain and lots of things happening. The state of Texas is in a true state of turmoil, as are parts of Louisiana and some surrounding areas. Thousands of people have been forced from their homes. They've, in most cases, had to leave everything behind. Some of them have been able to get out by vehicle. Some of them have been able to get out just on foot. Actually, there was an incident I saw the video on today of a woman who was kind of, they ran like a bucket line to get her pregnant woman out of her house, put her in the back of a dump truck, actually, so she could lay flat to get her to the hospital. The good news is she had her baby and the baby's doing fine. But the video of that gave us a good impression of something that we'll talk about today, which is the fact that it's not just what the government does and not even what organizations like Red Cross do, but how we help each other. And we'll talk a lot about that. We don't have hurricanes on the Central Coast, but the flip side is I don't think Texas and Louisiana have earthquakes, so we get to trade things back and forth. But we do need to really get an understanding of what we face both in natural and man-made disasters. So today, my guests are Paul Dees and Mark Penza, and they are it was interesting. The notations I got were they are both volunteers with the Red Cross. They're disaster volunteers. That is the understatement of the decade, and we'll get into that in a minute, because both of them are not just volunteers. At one point, Paul Dees was a paid. You were the Paul. Tell me, what was your formal title with the Red Cross?
My title at that time was the Director of Emergency Services for the Central Coast Region.
Okay, and Paul did a lot of things. We'll talk about from that standpoint. Mark Penza has been a volunteer with the Red Cross, and I actually know Mark. For full disclosure, I know Mark because he actually implies some time ago that I was his boss, but I wasn't his boss. But I was a city council member in Grover Beach while Mark was a police officer in Grover Beach, and I've known and admired Mark for a long time, and he's also a volunteer with the Red Cross. And both of them, even though it's like, you know, people say, okay, we're going to talk to some local volunteers from the Red Cross. We're going to talk to local volunteers from the Red Cross who have worked on things like Hurricane Sandy. Paul had indicated to me earlier before we were talking about the program a little bit that he's actually scheduled for deployment probably within about 3 weeks on the second wave of people to go work on Harvey, and we'll get into that in a little bit also. I want to remind you that this is a call-in program. You are welcome to be part of this discussion. Central Coast Voices is your community program on your community public radio station, KCBX. We'd like you to be part of the discussion if you choose to be. The phone number is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. If you have questions and things that you'd like to chat about and find out from these gentlemen, I would suggest that you call early. It's sometimes tough to get the calls in at the last minute, and that's really what we want to make sure doesn't happen, because we want you to have all the information you can possibly have. I'm going to get out of the way a little bit, and I'm going to start with Mark and then go to Paul. Give me some idea of what your background is, what things you've done with Red Cross with regard to disaster, because I think sometimes our listeners, as I said before, just think, oh, it's another volunteer that's going to tell me about volunteer opportunities. And I know for a fact that both of you have rather intricate life experiences in the work that you've done with Red Cross and other areas. Mark, jump in.
Yes, as with all my other Red Cross volunteers, we're trained in several different areas, as I am also. We have great training also. My number one thing that I do is I'm a part of logistics. We show up and we make sure people and things get where they need to be. My first time I deployed, I worked in the customer service area, well, actually interviewing people in hotels about 100 days after Hurricane Sandy had hit, and trying to find out what their plans were for their recovery and how we could help them and how we could move them along. So that's my number one thing. As with all volunteers, we're all trained in first aid and CPR also.
Okay, Paul, how about you?
Well, with the Red Cross, I've deployed about a dozen times now. The largest deployment is I spent a little over a month at Hurricane Sandy. I was on the first wave, arrived in New York, actually Newark, New Jersey, the day after the storm hit. That was pretty interesting to step into the largest city in the country, and it was a ghost town. No vehicles moving. It was a pretty crazy situation. I've also gone on floods in the Midwest, wildland fires on the West Coast, not just California, hurricanes. Been around a little bit with the Red Cross. My job is working in management at the disasters if I'm on a national deployment. And if it's a local emergency, like the fires we had here earlier this year and last year, my job is at first to help get the shelter open. So it's basically everybody is a shelter worker until we can get enough resources to branch out.
That brings up a good question that I didn't have on my question list. And I'm curious because one of the things that happened in Houston was they set up some shelters that they thought were on high enough ground and then discovered after they had them in use, but before they were fully deployed there, that actually they were not high enough ground. There was actually some photographs of some people who were, I guess, on their cots because it was the best way to keep your feet dry because there was literally already water in there, but they were, my understanding was they only had a foot or so of water in the building they were in, but they couldn't get people out because the surrounding area was far more flooded than that was. It's catch 22.
Well, what happens when we have a list in our region of almost 200 available locations to shelter? That's a facility that's already agreed to be a Red Cross shelter, has already been inspected, as we've already identified any shortcomings. For example, there's obviously ones we wouldn't use if we were setting up for a tsunami. There's ones that we wouldn't use if it was a wildland fire in the same general area. So we have to make our best estimate based on our knowledge, and we also check with the emergency responders. And the case of the one in Houston that you're referring to, that land was above the 500-year floodplain, significantly above the 500-year floodplain.
500-year floodplain.
Which is the largest floodplains that FEMA designates. The water overtopped the dam and the levee failed, the water went well above the 500-year floodplain. So, yes, those people are still, as far as I know, in the bleachers in that gymnasium because they have to get them out, and right now they can't. It's the same as we had one time where we had a shelter, we had people in the shelter, and the wildland fire turned and made a complete 180 and came back in a different direction, and we had to evacuate our shelter into another shelter. But we make those decisions based on information from the emergency responders and the previous inspections. And sometimes Mother Nature has another idea.
So, Mark, when you've set up, done logistics work with a major disaster, what are the first things you're looking for if you're coming into a community that you've never been in before, but you're coming in with a lot of skills that you can work with anywhere, they wouldn't have sent you there. What are the first things that you look for? What are the things that you're most concerned about?
Well, first off, when we get off the airplane and we're sent to the headquarters, finding the headquarters is sometimes difficult, and it's sometimes not as close as we would like. So you get oriented, you as you would in any disaster, just kind of know what's going on, show up to the headquarters. They tell you where you're going to go, and it's often different than what you were originally sent for. A year ago, when I went to Hurricane Matthew, I was supposed to go to West Palm Beach. Well, by the time I got to Jacksonville, Florida, which is where the main headquarters was, the hurricane had not come on land there, and they had a little bit of flooding and that much. The hurricane came passing across Jacksonville, Florida, caused some flooding, and then moved on and then slammed right on shore through the Carolinas, and that's where the real problem happened. So first off, I find out, well, I'm not going where I'm supposed to go, and you're not always doing what you're sent to do.
So you were prepared for something that was going to be south of you that actually literally ended up being north of you.
That's correct.
Yeah, which people are shifting resources.
Well, and that's the nature of a disaster. You know, there isn't a playbook. They aren't all the same. That's why we have to be fluid and just ready for anything. Because, well, just like with Paul discussing about the 500-year flood, I mean, who knew? I mean, really, at that point, you know, that it would get this crazy. This is the worst flooding we've ever had in recorded history. I mean, since Noah, I'm sure there's the worst flood that's been in this area. So you just have to be ready. You never know, and flexible to do whatever they need wherever you need it.
Hmm. You know, for example, we had about 25,000 volunteers on Hurricane Sandy, and they responded to a hurricane. And then we had 8 inches of snow. So people came thinking they were going to a hurricane-type climate. Or people who drove their emergency response vehicle from California, Texas, wherever, and all of a sudden there's snow on the roads they have to drive in that they've never seen before. So, yeah, you have to be my favorite motto is Semper Gumby. You have to be always flexible.
I love that. Yeah.
Semper Gumby, okay. Is that an official Red Cross term?
I'm trying.
Let me remind you folks, we're talking with two long-term volunteers with the American Red Cross. They're both based here on the Central Coast, but they've dealt with a lot of incidents across the country. If you want to be part of the discussion, if you have some questions for them, please give us a call. The phone number is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. This is a fascinating topic. As I mentioned, if you're just joining the program now, I've known both Paul and Mark outside of this venue for many, many years and know their backgrounds, and they're both fascinating fellows to talk to about this kind of thing. As you're talking about evacuees sitting in bleachers at a gymnasium, what comes to my mind is that if I'm an evacuee there and I've got dry shoes and I'm just sitting there, listening to an NPR podcast on my smartphone because I have nothing else to do but sit in the shelter, I'm one of those people that the first thing I'm thinking about is, instead of sitting here as an evacuee, what can I do? And I'm wondering, is that a subgroup of people that you get in every disaster, the people who even in the middle of a disaster where maybe the thing I'm thinking about is, oh, you know, my entire home is washed out and all of my pictures of my grandparents that I was trying to restore are gone, and I'm very sad about that, but doggone it, I'm not going to sit here and do nothing. And there are those helper people versus spectator people in my language.
Not just spectator people. Unfortunately, the media has to find things exciting so you don't change the channel. So they'll often film the negatives. I have seen the most incredible outpouring of love and help from fellow disaster victims to each other. Hurricane Sandy, we saw people who we jokingly said were young youths organization. They were gang members helping the elderly in their neighborhood online all day long so they could get food that was being delivered by the Red Cross and other agencies, helping to clean up everyone's homes, protecting each other. Mm-hmm. People will do what they can to help each other. When we're in a shelter, you have some people that are very, very distraught. And you have people who are also distraught on the inside, but they help themselves by sitting down next to that person who's really distraught and giving them one of the most valuable things you can give, and that's a hug. And you see people stepping up to help each other more often than anything else.
That's good to know, and it's really good to know because I think about the fact that we think that the Red Cross will be there to help, and you are, okay? FEMA, in most cases, with a few exceptions over the years that have made really big news, and we can stay away from those. FEMA is generally there long-term to come up with some good things for a lot of people. But a lot of it is just people helping each other. One of the things that I heard has happened about with Harvey is that when phone systems weren't working anymore, but cell phone to cell phone was working, but cell phone to like dispatch centers for 911 and stuff weren't working, people were using Facebook to say, I'm on the roof of such and such building with my two kids, and getting a Facebook post back from somebody that basically said, I've got a canoe about two blocks from you, we'll be over in a little while. We tend to not, well, I talk about that kind of stuff a lot because that's what I admire in my fellow man, but I'm surprised that that doesn't make as much of the history and the news about this kind of thing that we've seen.
I believe it has this time in Texas. I mean, the response of the people that bring in their fishing boats out or whatever boats they have and going just up and down the streets and using social media. I mean, social media has turned out to be a godsend in a lot of cases, as it was here. So you've got people going up and down the streets just looking for people and trying to help each other. And I've seen that in every national disaster and even the local ones, disasters that we've gone to, is that people will help each other. They'll step up and do whatever they have to do to, because it's their community. Red Cross is there, and we love them. We'll get them out of danger. We'll set them up out of the elements, give them food and clothing. But we're not there forever. They're there forever. And thank God they pulled together, and they've been wonderful this time. I think it's been pretty well reported.
Yeah, it's good to hear. And you're right. I think we've heard it more this time than we've heard it in other disasters. I mean, Paul's story about the gang people who helped the elderly there with their food. It's a story you've shared with me before, and I knew it's a very touching story. There's a lot of people like that that got no recognition.
Yeah, and you know, when you mentioned about the using the cell phones, and I was going to bring this up when we talk about preparedness, in order for you to make a phone call, it takes a lot of data. And if the phone on the other end is busy, you're not going to get through. Maybe you'll get to leave a voicemail. On most phones, if you send a text message, it takes a millisecond of data, and most phones, if they can't get through, they'll continue to try to send it until they're successful. So in time of disaster, text versus tying up the phone lines with voice calls.
Interesting. It had not occurred to me that was a big factor, yeah.
Yeah, because otherwise you can overload the cell phone services.
Yeah, and maybe we'll talk about that a little more when we'll go over in a little bit a checklist of things people need to think about. I reminded my family that the proverbial, well, my iPhone does really well for 4 days on one charge, is probably not a good idea, because on day four, when something comes up and you can't charge it, it may be a big crisis. So I think that's something we can talk about also. On a local level, what do you see? We've talked before. Paul's been on the program before. Mark, this is your first time with us. But you've talked before, Paul, about things that we need to do locally to pay attention to what's important. I guess get a kit is one of the phrases.
Well, the first thing is be aware. What's the temperature in North County today? It's over 100. It's been over 100 for a week. It's going to be over 100 all next week. What happens when you have temperatures like that? Fires. So guess what? It's fire season. Guess what? It's extreme fire weather right now. So if you live in an area where you're surrounded by wildland, you might as well just plan on having to evacuate. If by the end of the summer you didn't have to, hey, that's great. But if you planned on it and all of a sudden that column of smoke was going up next to you, you wouldn't have to think, okay, now what am I going to gather to get out of here? You just grab it and go. So you got to be aware of your surroundings. Be aware of what's going on. Be aware of the weather. We can't tell you when the next earthquake is. But we can tell you we're going to have wildland fires now. There'll be rain sometime, hopefully this winter. when we're going to get flooding. You just have to be prepared. You have to have a plan. I know that if the Cuesta Grade closes before this program is over and I can't go home, my wife and me already have a plan on how we're going to communicate with each other. I have a disaster kit in my car. I have 3 days worth of food and water with me all the time. So I have a plan and I have a way. And I'm sure Mark does too.
Yeah. Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you don't, shame on you.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things I remember from the last time you were here, and it's been almost, I think, 3 years ago since you were on the program, was those of us who used to run around until the little red light went on our gas tank saying it was time to fill the tank are very foolish, because when everybody needs to fill their gas tank, if they need to get out of the area, there's a long line at the nearest gas station. So I believe your recommendation, as it stuck in my mind, was don't travel around with less than a half full tank of gas all the time.
Exactly. I fill my car at half a tank. And it's always never less than half a tank.
You have an electric car, Paul.
Well, I have one plug-in hybrid and one regular hybrid. So, yes, my half a tank of gas will take me 400 miles. But
that's okay. I know your car will help charge my cell phone, too.
Yes, it will.
Well, and, you know, and the other thing that happens is that in a disaster, a lot of times electricity goes out.
Yeah.
If there's no electricity, there's no gas. The pumps all operate on electricity.
That's true. That's
unless
very,
you've
yeah,
got
a
pump
that, yeah.
system somewhere. So, yeah, never let your tank get below a half or, you know, or a one quarter low. It's just part of being prepared.
You know, again, back to Sandy. Day four of Hurricane Sandy, New York ran out of fuel. Period.
The whole state of New York.
The whole metropolitan area of New York City.
Okay.
There was no fuel other than what was already in their storage tanks at the fire stations.
Mm-hmm.
There was a hospital that had to be evacuated, not because it was damaged, because there was no power and it ran out of fuel for its emergency generators. And this is the largest city in the country, and they couldn't get fuel to it. How quickly is San Luis Obispo County going to run out of gasoline?
Yeah. And that brings up a side story, because I haven't looked at the news very much today, so I don't know what all has happened, but there has already been some explosions at some chemical plants. And one of the things that I actually heard some news about that last night was one of the plants had backup generators, but then their backup generators flooded, and they moved things that needed to be refrigerated into semi-trailers that were refrigeration units until the diesel engines for those were underwater, and that's when they basically then looked at telling people that not only can you not come back to this area because of water, but we have not an explosion that might happen, but they pretty much said when this stuff is no longer at a below certain temperature, it's likely to explode, but there's no way to get it all out of there. So that's a factor that came up there. We can talk about that a little more. We do have a call from Lucy in San Luis Obispo. Lucy, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for your patience while I talk too much. What do you want to add?
No problem.
Okay. What are your questions for my guest today?
I wanted to make a statement and ask them to respond to it, but I would suggest that the listeners should think about what they would do should there be a radiation release from Diablo Canyon. We just had a siren test, so I think local people are probably aware that's your first warning should something happen. But I'm not sure too many people have made decisions about what they would do should the situation arise. The two basic choices are try to evacuate, which means getting on 101 freeway, and you may well end up just sitting there and not going anywhere after the roads got flooded. I mean, too busy. And the other choice is to stay inside, shelter in place. And then people with families need to think about if your children are in school, what would you do? Anyway, I won't talk any more than that. I'll just say I would suggest that people look at the Office of Emergency Services website, because that does outline very well what choices are, and think ahead about it, because you don't want to not think about it and then just be in a panic and not have any idea what you want to do first.
Okay. Good point, Lucy. Thanks very much.
That was great, Lucy. I can actually speak to that because I've been involved with the County Office of Emergency Services a lot in the past, including Diablo drills. They do have a very robust plan, which is on their website. And yeah, you're right. You have a choice. You can shelter in place if that's what the emergency services direct you to do, or you could leave. It's a decision you need to make now. Because if you decide, if they ever have something at Diablo, I'm leaving no matter what, you do want to get on the road before everybody else does. However, in most cases, that won't be necessary. But I wouldn't know, but the county will. They have monitoring stations all over the county, and they'll know if there's a release. Plus, Diablo will let us know if there's a release. And sheltering in place could be the perfect option, because it may be a very short term. But if you don't have that fuel in your tank and you don't have a go kit ready to go, and then you start trying to figure out how to get out of town, it's too late. But it's very similar to most other disasters. If you're going to evacuate, you got to be ready now to do that evacuation.
Okay. So a go kit. What is a go kit?
Okay. You know, kick it back to me.
No, you guys get to decide who answers the question.
Okay. A go kit, simply as I described the one I carry in my car, it's a backpack in case I have to walk.
Okay.
And it is 3 days' worth of water in Mylar envelopes that you can get locally at camping supply stores because they have a 10-year shelf life. It has some emergency food, which isn't like your favorite thing to have for dinner,
but it's got a five-year shelf life. What is the quantity of water that's considered a three-day supply of water?
To stay alive,
okay.
Not happy,
okay.
Not working hard. To stay alive, you need 16 ounces of water a day.
Okay.
Okay. To be truly functional in your disaster kit that maybe you have at home, you got to plan on a gallon per person per day, but that's to wash yourself, to drink, to maybe prepare food in.
Okay.
But in your go kit, I have 16 4-ounce things of water. I have an energy, special bar that's put together that breaks into little components. That's good for 3 days' worth of food. I have a poncho. I have a flashlight. I have a whistle. I have cash in $1 bills because ATMs may not work in a disaster.
Okay.
And if that bottle of water you have, you're willing to sell to me and all I have is a 20, that's what it's going to cost. So $1 bills, I have a copy of my ID, a copy of my insurance papers, both health insurance, car insurance, and homeowner's insurance, an extra pair of socks. So basically, you got to think, what do I need to stay alive? Water. What's next after water? Food.
Okay.
Okay. After food, some kind of shelter, which can be an emergency blanket or a poncho. A way to get to where I'm going. I got fuel in the car. What's on my feet?
Okay.
So that's the basics of it. And actually, if you want to get a good long list of a preparedness kit, you go to American Red Cross or redcross.org, and there's a good listing of everything that you'd want in a kit.
Okay. And as I remind listeners a lot, because sometimes people will not go find something because they can't remember the website we suggested to them. Never underestimate the power of Google to help you find what you want. If you don't like Google, there's also Bing and Yahoo, but there's wonderful search engines. So if you basically were to even Google a go kit.
Or disaster kit.
Disaster kit or a Red Cross disaster kit, you're going to find the information you need.
Plus, I know that the hardware stores and the camping supply store here in San Luis, they sell them ready to go. They're ready in a backpack. They already have everything in them you need them. You could just go and pick one up.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could build it yourself.
Okay. One of you, and I can't remember under what circumstances, alluded to the fact that having a plan with your family or your immediately closest people, family or friends, as to where you meet or how you communicate or how you connect so people can, find out if each other's safe. I mean, I was out of town for a conference for 5 days down in San Diego, and if something had happened here and I couldn't get a hold of my wife or kids on the cell phone for whatever reason, we had a plan of the out of area person that we can connect with. So if it happened in San Luis County, our family member that's in San Jose is our point person. So I'm wondering, is there a particular strategy for that works well?
Just so they're out of the area, have everyone know that they're going to call Aunt Kathy, you know, in Jacksonville, Illinois, if something goes wrong. And because sometimes it's easier for the circuits to go long distance than it is to bounce around the area. And if everyone knows that ahead of time, has the number ahead of time, and Aunt Kathy knows that, or whoever else is there, then it makes it easy for everyone to get back together. Because disasters don't happen when it's convenient. You know, they don't happen at 9 o'clock in the morning after breakfast and everyone is still there. You know, it happens when we're scattered and not ready and not in the mood for it. You know, it's never good. That's why they call them disasters. So have the plan, make sure everyone knows that, and bring it up every once in a while. Now's a good time. The best time to review something is when you see it happening to someone else. And God forbid it should happen here. Get your people ready. Get the ones you love and your family and friends and neighbors. Make sure they all have a plan and they're ready to go. At least in a hurricane, you have some time to get ready. You know it's coming. And you can make plans to do that. And in fact, Red Cross is already en route to the hurricane before it hits. But where we are, unless it's a wildfire, it's going to be an earthquake. So it shakes, it's over, and then everybody responds. So there's no time for pre-planning. Hurricanes, tornadoes, you have, you know, well, not with tornadoes so much, but with hurricanes, you have a day or two to rethink about things and do it again. Earthquakes, it happens, and then that's it, man. You're ready or you're not.
Yeah. There's also social media again. Facebook had an incredible response. They put up a thing to check in on Facebook. You could check in that I'm okay at the disaster, and people could search by your name if they were your friend on Facebook to see if you've checked in. And the Red Cross has a thing called Safe and Well Linking. It's on the Red Cross website, plus it's also at when you're at the shelter, you can register yourself in Safe and Well Linking. One of the nice things on that is you can tell the Red Cross who you'll let know that you're there in case there's somebody you don't want them to know that you're there, like in a spousal abuse situation or something.
Okay, yeah.
So, yeah, you want to have that outside contact. My sister Ro in New Jersey is who everybody in our family on the West Coast calls. I'm the person on the West Coast. If anybody on the East Coast needs to check in with each other.
Okay. Let me remind folks that we are talking with some wonderful, insightful volunteers from the Red Cross who have worked on many, many disasters and incidents in their careers. You can give us a call, chat about what you may have some questions about or some observations. The phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. And we've got some time left and some time to talk to you. Please don't wait till the last 5 minutes of the program to call in, but we can gladly put you on now. And we have lots of things to talk about, both what's gone on with the current hurricane circumstances in Texas and Louisiana to other disasters in history, and also things what we can look at locally. Both of you may have worked with this. I know Paul's worked with it, and since you worked on Sandy also, I think you probably worked with it. I think there's a lot of people to feed. I mean, and it's not, and I don't just mean the volunteers. I mean, there's people in shelters that have the Safeway is not open in the middle of a flood. So we need to get people fed. I was surprised, Paul, I was surprised when you told me that one of the largest providers of mobile kitchens and food service is a Baptist organization, and you worked with them on Sandy. How do you feed 10,000 people?
Well, I'll give you an example. So far, as of this morning, we have served 250,000 meals for this hurricane, and that's not the Red Cross doing it on their own. The Southern Baptist Coalition has mobile kitchens all over the United States. And kind of the way it works is the Red Cross procures the supplies to meet the needs of the Southern Baptist menu. The Southern Baptist Coalition cooks the food, which then gets loaded into Red Cross vehicles and taken to where it's needed. And there's other organizations. Those are just the two largest. For example, when we had the fires here in our county just a month or so ago, in our case, the Salvation Army came down to our shelter location and prepared the food for the people in the shelter. So depending on the size of the disaster, we all work together. Now, when the disaster first hits, especially a big one, that great meal you get might be an MRE. It might be a couple of snack energy bars.
Define an MRE for people who may not know.
Meals ready to eat. It's a military, it's what our troops are eating when they're working in the field.
Used to be referred to as C rations long time ago, or K rations.
Or meals rejected by everyone, yes.
never heard that reference
yeah,
before.
But it starts out with what we have. Restaurants are going to be inundated. Supermarkets are going to be empty. The Red Cross has a contract with food purveyors across the country, the largest ones in the country, to provide the food that we need, to work with other agencies to prepare the food. We'll serve food at fixed locations. And then in this example, so far, we have 200 of our emergency response vehicles, which are looks like the big ambulance. And its purpose is to deliver food and supplies. We have 200 of those from all across the country right now that are working this hurricane, delivering that food to people.
My thought is this example right now, you can call the Safeway. I guess if you have a contract with Safeway's warehouse, you can call the warehouse, but how do you then – I mean, nobody was prepared for this. Well, they were prepared a few days in advance, but not by much. Okay, the area we're most concerned about is Houston. If you can't roll trucks into Houston with food in them, and yeah, I realize you can bring in some stuff with helicopters and other things, but you don't, that doesn't move a lot of food real fast. How are the logistics of that handled?
Well, that's a big part of what Mark was talking about. It's not simple. You have to figure out where can we get it.
Yeah, and that becomes an issue. Of course, you look the closest near you, and then, you know, the next ring out from that, and then out from that. And then, you know, you've got food coming in from a state over in a lot of cases. And we have a lot of partners. Red Cross is probably the largest, I guess, of disaster responders. There's a lot of other partners that chip in and do a lot of extra things. And the local people, even the ones that weren't as affected by the disaster, chip in and do whatever they can. And local food purveyors and restaurants sometimes will stay open and put some food together for us. And we just hope that the cavalry come in the form of those big, huge trucks that are kitchens, that they can actually start preparing meals for the people, both in the shelters. And we put them in the IRFs and go out and looking for people that need food.
And it's like I said, I have 3 days' worth of food in my car at home. I have food for five, even though there's only two people living there, because you might be visiting when the disaster hits. I have food for five for 2 weeks.
When I'm visiting a disaster hits,
right.
I guess okay.
Because it
happens often. It's okay.
Because in a large disaster, those trucks are not going to get there for a while. You know, think if we have a big earthquake in California that's kind of halfway between us and Los Angeles, that impacts both us and Los Angeles, where do you think the food trucks are going to get to first? Probably not San Luis Obispo. So we're going to be on our own for a while.
You know, my thought is whether or not, and I don't know how your procurement contracts work, but whether or not the existence of Costco and Sam's Club on a nationwide basis actually becomes part of your warehousing. It's like, okay, we know what we can get out of the freezer cases at a Costco or Sam's Club quickly, and we have the paper trail to do it. So I'm assuming that kind of thing is...
In a small disaster, like our wildland fires we had here this year, Costco, for example, delivered pallets of water to us, donated the pallets of water and delivered them. In a large disaster, this Costco is going to be empty really quick, so we can't rely on it. We may use it, hopefully, to get our first meal out, but after that, we're going to have to bring in stuff from outside, because guess what? Everyone else is also at Costco trying to get what they need, if Costco's even able to open their doors.
Good point.
If you look at the San Simeon earthquake, it really severely damaged the Orchard Supply hardware store in Paso Robles. Orchard Supply had a plan, and they brought truck loads of everything that was in that store from elsewhere in California. And all they did at the store was sent the employees home and kept a couple people there to hand out whatever water, flashlights, and batteries they had for free until people from the rest of the Orchard Supply organization could get there and clean up the store and get it reopened. So your plan of getting something locally in even a medium-sized disaster probably isn't going to work. You got to already have it.
Yeah. So when the two of you think about what may be needed of you on this disaster, you've mentioned to me before, I think that you put people kind of in waves or crews, because if it takes well, probably a short estimate, if it takes 6 months to wait out of this enough for everybody to be able to even do something for themselves reasonably well, that's a long period of time. You can't expect volunteers from the Red Cross or the Southern Baptist Coalition to basically staff the facilities forever. So do you work, you have a rotational crew plan? How does that work?
Yes. My first disaster response, I had been officially in Red Cross 3 days when I went to Superstorm Sandy. And this was about 100 days after it had come aground. At this point in time, everyone's out of the shelters, but there's still nowhere to go. So all the hotels in the area are filled with people that have nowhere else to go. And they eat there, and they're taken care of. FEMA basically is picking up the bill at that point. Red Cross is this big, nice concern, and thanks to the generosity of a lot of people like yourself, we have a lot of money and a lot of people that donate their time. But FEMA has the backing of the entire government, so they're picking up the tab at this point, most of all. So they're in different hotels around the area. What I did in Superstorm Sandy, I was part of a group that every day we'd get a printout of people that had not been contacted. This is 100 days after the hurricane. They hadn't been contacted yet for us to find out where they were, what happened, how did they get out, what is their plan for their recovery, and we would get that information and in like a 12-page report give that to FEMA every day. Well, and the issue is that everyone ultimately is responsible for their own recovery. Red Cross can get there immediately. We can put a roof over their head, give them some food, money for clothes if they need it. FEMA can step in for a little bit, but everyone is ultimately responsible for their own recovery. And that's what we start doing. We say, well, what are your plans? And we try to help them with their plans. In this case, since there was no housing anymore, it was all gone, we were telling people, hey, if you've ever thought about moving somewhere else in the country, this is a nice time to think about it. So we actually gave people money for moving vans, and we gave them first month's rent, last month's rent, and just security deposits to move to Oklahoma to be with, you know, Uncle Steve or whatever. So, yeah, they can't be in shelters forever. The tent thing or the school thing doesn't work because people tend to want their schools back, mm-hmm. you know, their churches back. So they go to hotels, and then after that, we try to get them somewhere else.
Yeah.
Permanently.
The process, well, for you guys as volunteers, again, we can't expect you to stay there for a long period of time. You have families and other obligations. Paul, when I know what your schedule was because we talked about it when you were working Sandy. Mark, I don't remember exactly what your timeline was on that. You actually had a day job. Still had a day job, even though you're now retired from being retired and everything else these days. So you had to work out with your employer how long you were going to be gone and what was going on.
Right. And also, like, for example, right now, we're not sending much resources from here because guess what? We talked about 20 minutes ago. We're on fire.
Fire. Yeah.
So if we were to send everybody here to go help in the hurricane, first of all, we would deplete all of our available resources in case we needed something now, like there's a big fire in Oregon, and it could be another one here today. Also, people, you're not going down to Houston for vacation. You're going into a place that, in most cases, a Red Cross deployment is 3 weeks. It can be extended, but it starts out as a three-week deployment because it's hard. If we have a choice of we have one cot and we have a client and we have a worker, the worker's sleeping on the floor. If we have enough hot food to not get everybody food, the clients are getting the food. We're eating the leftovers. It's hard, hard, very emotionally impacting work. So we try to put people in for 3 weeks at a time and not longer. Occasionally, we'll keep them longer, especially Superstorm Sandy was so big. Mm-hmm. Many people were there for about 6 weeks. So when we're looking here for us, we're not right dead center in the disaster area. We're a little further away. So they'll look at if our fire season mellows out, sending people from here in about week three, week four, if we can. And they would be expected to go for 3 weeks. And then 3 weeks after that, more people would go. The Red Cross has a very robust system for when we put in that we're available to say that, first of all, you're available, and second, to look at the overall needs of the entire Red Cross. We have shelters open for this storm. We have shelters open in Florida from the tropical storm that just went there. We have shelters open in California and Oregon and Washington for wildland fires. So it's not just this one need. There's needs everywhere. And then we do a day-to-day response of responding to single-family fires, 75,000 a year nationwide.
And I'm glad you bring that up, because one of my first observations on the Central Coast was there was a fire near where I lived in Oceano. This is quite some years ago. And there was an apartment house, two or three unit apartments, that there was a fire. And the Red Cross had their response unit there, among other things, making sure there was enough water for the firefighters when they came off duty in a rotation, because it was a rather ugly fire when it happened. But also looking, I believe the Red Cross helped find, for lack of a better word, motel space for the families were displaced from that, and that was going on locally.
Well, just in our local chapter, out of the San Luis Obispo and Santa Maria area, so far in 2017, we've done 25 of those what we call disaster action team responses. We've taken care of 37 families, and we spent about $25,000 in direct relief costs to those 37 families. So what we do at 2 in the morning, while the fire department's putting out the fire in your house, is we get you safe, we get you into a hotel, we look at your needs, and we either can fulfill some of those needs financially for you right then, or again, as Mark said, we have lots of partner agencies, so we may be able to connect you up with a partner to help you with what's next. And so we can't take all of our DAT responders and send them to the hurricane, because who's going to be here for the fire tonight? Or if we have to open a shelter. We've opened five shelters so far this year in our area.
And some of those individual shelters we opened two or three times?
Yes, we opened in May.
Actually, I believe, my wife teaches at Flamson Middle School, and before the school year was over last year, that was a shelter facility, their gymnasium.
Yes, we opened it twice at Flamson for wildland fires. We've opened twice in Santa Margarita for wildland fires. We've opened at the I always pronounce Menami Center in Santa Maria, for wildland fire. And then we did another one down in Ventura area. I don't remember exactly where
we had a high school in Santa Barbara.
For the fires down there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we can get spread out. So we have to hold enough resources here, but still be available to help elsewhere. And then even when we had that last set of fires, we had four shelters open at once. That's beyond what we normally plan to do here. So we had resources coming from other parts of California to help us.
Yeah. For an operation at that size, how do you feed people?
We had a mixture. Some was, as I said, Salvation Army was feeding at one of the shelters. The shelter up in Santa Margarita, several local restaurants said, how many people you got to feed? And they donated the food. Yeah. I hesitate to say the names because I'll miss one, and that wouldn't be fair to the ones, but I wish I could remember exactly every one. But it seemed like every meal there was another restaurant saying, how do we help?
Mm-hmm.
So
what do we want to make sure? People are paying attention to what's going on in Texas, and we don't want any, oops, I didn't notice what's going on in my own backyard. And that's important, and that's part of why we brought you here today, because we want people to, when we have something like this happen, as tragic as it is, it becomes an opportunity to remind people about what's truly important locally that we need to pay attention to. You mentioned your kits that you have all over the place. What are the other things that people need to think about and pay attention to?
We put it in three simple steps.
Okay.
Be aware of what's going on.
Okay.
Have a plan for what you and your family are going to do, whether you're at home or out in the car somewhere, and then have a set of disaster supplies. Because you really have a simple choice in time of a disaster. You are either a victim of that disaster, or you're someone who's going to help others. So if you take care of yourself, then you can start taking care of your neighbors. So that's what you can do to be prepared yourself. And you can go to redcross.org to find out more about a kit and having a plan. You contact the local Red Cross office to see when's the next place time we're going to be doing a presentation on disaster preparedness. Then the other thing you can do if you want to help, is you can donate. People don't understand Red Cross is not a government agency. Matter of fact, we can't be a government agency because the Red Cross, International Red Cross, is the keeper of the Geneva Conventions. So if we want that's to be able to take care of a prisoner of war in another country with our American Red Cross, we can't be part of the government. So we see very little funding from the government via grants. Most of the funding comes from me and you. So you can go to redcross.org and donate money that way. If a real simple way you want to help the people for the Harvey response, you can text Harvey to 90999. So you text the word Harvey to 90999, and that'll take a $10 donation automatically. That'll go to specifically the response for Harvey.
I think you did that. Red Cross did that for Sandy also, because I recall that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the simplest way to get small donations. And believe it or not, you know, it's great when you hear about somebody gave $1 million to the Red Cross. Most of the money comes in $10, $20 at a time. That's where most of the money that the Red Cross uses. And the Red Cross, there's an organization that evaluates nonprofits. And they tell you, you know, what's this nonprofit really doing? And I looked it up because sometimes people ask. So for last fiscal year, this outside organization said that 90.1%, so 90 cents of every dollar donated to the Red Cross was used for direct relief of people.
That's very good.
Yeah.
And that's the benchmark a lot of organizations have to look at now, because we still get phone calls from a lot of charitable efforts, and if you don't ask, sometimes a good portion of their resources are going to the marketing of those phone calls and things like that. So that's it's good to know.
Yeah, the Red Cross is somewhere in the neighborhood of 92% volunteers. And, you know, and we do a lot more than just respond to these disasters. For example, last year we gave away approximately 1,000 free smoke alarms in our region.
I never knew that was a project of the Red Cross.
Yeah, we work together with local fire agencies to identify neighborhoods in need and go by door to door and offer people some quick training on disaster preparedness and free smoke alarms. And we install the smoke alarms for them. We also are, it's called Service to Armed Forces. The Red Cross was founded during the Civil War by Clara Barton, trying to help people on the battlefield. Well, if you have a loved one in the armed forces and need to get an emergency message to them, it's the Red Cross that vets that for you and gets that message to those. Or you need to have a service member come home because of an emergency at home. Again, it's the Red Cross that vets that needs and gets that person home for you. Yeah. We've trained 9,000 people last year in CPR and first aid. We've educated over 1,000 people in how to be better prepared for a disaster. Our volunteers average about 10,000 hours of work a year in our local region. And we have just over 600 volunteers just in our local area.
We're down to the last few minutes, and as most of my listeners know and some of my guests know, that I do my best to get out of the way for the last few minutes and give people a chance to talk about what they think we may have missed here. And Mark, Paul's done most of the talking, but you and I have known Paul for a long time. He out-talks me, which is scary in its own right.
Yes.
A couple of minutes. What are the things you want to make sure that that folks remember and walk away with in their back pocket for both their own safety and for things about the Red Cross?
Be prepared. Know that it's just not if there's going to be a disaster here. And of course, that would probably be an earthquake. So have a plan, be ready for that. Think about what you do. Think about what you had to do if you had to camp out in your front yard for 3 days and the only thing you had was what you had with you. So that some way to put something over your head, something to eat, something to drink, and some way to contact other people to let them know you're okay. Another thing, just real quick, that's not exactly Red Cross, but is part of preparedness, have insurance. Even if you're a renter, especially if you're a renter, make sure you have renter's insurance, because your recovery is going to be much easier with that. If not, it's, well, you know, good luck, have a nice day, let us know how it turns out. So that's one other way to be prepared.
Okay. What do we need to teach our kids? What about this? Is there anything that we haven't talked about? we've talked about what we do in our community and what the Red Cross does. Are we doing enough to make sure our kids have a grounding of information on this?
We need to teach the kids, and I'd like to, with my grandkids and earlier with my kids, make them part of the planning for a disaster. Where are we going to go if we have a house fire? Or we're going to meet down at the mailbox. Okay, what are we going to do when we get there? Okay, how about tomorrow or sometime next week, you announce the fire drill. And when you announce it, we're all going to drop whatever we have and go practice our evacuation drill. To tell your youngster, we're giving you permission, if you wake up in the middle of the night, to wake us all up and say it's fire drill time, that puts them as part of it. Another really important thing in a disaster is comfort, mental and physical comfort. If you have children in your disaster kit, take that stuffed animal that they don't use anymore, the one that got replaced this year on their birthday, put their old stuffed animal in there. Chem lights, the chemical lights that you snap, they're great for kids in a disaster. There's no electricity. They're scared. When the lights go out, you snap the chem light. That's theirs. They go to sleep. They put it under their pillow. If they wake up, they can lift it, and they got light. It's real comforting.
Very good point.
Have a battery-operated radio, or even better, there's these radios that are battery-operated. They have a solar panel on the top and a hand crank on the side and a USB port on the side for charging your cell phone. And they'll listen to the radio, like KCBX, on the air to tell you what to do.
I'm surprised that you didn't mention that far earlier in the program, the radio. My goodness, that's a very good point, yeah. Real quick, we got a little bit of time, and I want to, while I think about it, because we didn't mention it very much. If people want to volunteer, I mean, some people say, gee, I don't have a lot of financial resources to donate to the Red Cross, but I've got some time and energy. How do you become a volunteer?
Well, you can go to the local Red Cross office or go to redcross.org and you fill out an application to become a volunteer. There's a little bit of a process we have to go through. We have to give you some training, and we also have to make sure you're an okay person, because we're going to now put other people's lives in your hands in a shelter. So we can't just throw you into it. But we're always looking for more people. We have jobs like working in a shelter. We have jobs that might be pushing paper on a desk. We have jobs that might be done remotely. So even if you are, you don't have to be some big, strapping, strong person. We've got work for people of all abilities and all knowledge levels. If you've got technical expertise, we can use you. If you've got paperwork, computer skills, we can use you.
Good to know. Yeah, I have a friend down in Southern California who basically is housebound by disability that does work for the Red Cross because they do some phone, I want to say phone bank things, but it really isn't. It's some following up by phone with other incidents and stuff like that. This has been a terrific program, gentlemen. I thank you very much for being with us. If you missed any of this program, it'll be on audio tape for you shortly, but also go to redcross.org or just Google the Red Cross and find out what you can do in your own home and your own community. There's a lot of things available for you, and thank you for sharing this with us. This has been Central Coast Voices, as you know. I'm glad you've been with us. We're a project of action for healthy communities. And Chris Kington Barker will be with you next week. Her program has not been completely finalized yet, so I'm not quite sure what that's going to be, but she'll be with us. Thanks to Joan Gellert Sargent for her underwriting of this program in engineering, and to KCBX for their co-sponsorship of the program. You can reach Central Coast Voices at voices@kcbx.org. or 543-2323. Thank you to my guests, Paul Dees and Mark Pensa. And up next is This American Life, my favorite program on this station. Glad you could be with us at KCBX.